I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. When the first man to leave our biosphere by rocket, now that's just a roundabout sort of way to talk about the first man in space, well, when he returned to Earth, there was no official welcoming committee. In fact, the first humans to greet this returning first man from space, they just weren't expecting him at all. He just kind of showed up, rather terrifyingly, from way up there, unannounced. Actually, you might say that he was not welcome at all. Yuri Gagarin was greeted by a very confused and disoriented farmer woman and her granddaughter. The whole scene would seem a bit over the top even in a Hollywood movie, even for sci-fi, I think. But in the larger story of the human ambition to travel from Earth out into space and back, I suppose these curious facts of his welcome or unwelcome back on Earth, it's really quite fitting. An astronaut lands, he's in the wrong place altogether, and the two women he greets have no idea who he is or how he actually got there. And it's pretty scary. Our next guest on Constant Wonder has written an account of all the particulars of Yuri Gagarin's spaceflight and what this event signaled for the world, especially for the two superpowers vying for superiority in all things technical as well as all things geopolitical. I'm talking about the USSR and the United States, of course. Stephen Walker is a writer and an award-winning documentary filmmaker. His films have won British Academy Film and Television Arts Awards, BAFTAs, an Emmy, and Royal Television Society Awards. Walker is now author of a new book titled Beyond, the astonishing story of the first human to leave our planet and journey into space. And it's a pleasure to have him with us on the show today. Stephen Walker, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thanks very much for having me.
Stephen, just to get the ball rolling here, how many dogs did the Soviets send up into space before ever sending a human?
They sent 42 of them. Can you believe it? I mean, it's quite incredible that most people, if they think about Soviet space dogs at all or know anything, might have heard of one of them called Laika, who was a female mongrel who was sent into space in 1957, shortly after the first satellite called Sputnik was sent up by the Soviets. And the desperately sad thing about that was they didn't have the technology to bring Laika home again, so she basically died in orbit. In fact, she died on her way, really, to orbit. It was pretty horrendous. And most people think that's the only one, but there were, in fact, 41 others of them. And they were there because the Soviets were desperately trying to find out what it was like to send organic, complex organic beings and eventually human beings into space. They had absolutely no idea. They didn't know if people would go insane. They didn't know if their eyeballs would burst. They didn't know if they'd be able to still breathe, if their heart would actually continue to beat or the blood circulate. It was all of that stuff. So they sent up 42, 21 of them. I think approximately 21 of them, I have the figure in my book, actually were killed in various pretty gruesome ways, going up to space or actually in space. And one of them, amazingly, ran away just minutes before launch. I mean, she actually just got away. I mean, these were strays picked up from the streets of Moscow, basically. And this one got away, and they had to replace her with another dog that they found, who was unlucky enough to be found wandering outside the kind of canteen on the rocket base. And they literally picked her up and put her in the rocket instead and blasted her up into space. It's an incredible story. It's in my book.
You know, I'm just thinking about the expense of... Are we talking about one rocket per dog?
Sometimes two dogs per rocket.
It's still expensive.
Yeah, it was expensive. And I tell you, the technology, I mean, you're talking about one of the most dramatic times in the 20th century. I mean, you're talking about the very epicenter of the Cold War. You've got to imagine, Berlin Wall is about to be built. Vietnam War is about to start. It's really hotting up out there. Fidel Castro has just become the communist president of Cuba, which is just, you know, off the coast of Florida, so a real threat to the United States of America. And so you're right in the center of the Cold War. And the technology required to put a human being in space is cutting-edge stuff. So the Soviets protect their technology in a very peculiar way, very differently from the Americans. What they do is they do everything in secret. At least they do everything to begin with in secret. And if it's successful, then they'll announce it. But if it's not successful, they won't announce it, or they just lie about it. But they also, incredibly, and it's one of the things I write about, it actually starts the book, they also put bombs. The KGB insist on putting bombs on board Soviet spacecraft, carrying these dogs, so that if anything goes wrong and the spacecraft starts heading towards a capitalist country like the decadent West, like America, like the United Kingdom, wherever, this bomb was triggered to explode. And it would blow up the spacecraft, and it would blow up the dog or two dogs inside the spacecraft, so there'd be no trace of this spacecraft existing at all. And that's one of the ways they protected their technology from spying and prying eyes like the CIA, who were desperate to find out what was going on.
So amid all this secrecy, once a successful dog launch and return happens, is that made public?
Yeah, if it's successful, it's made public. So the launches, including the launch of Yuri Gagarin himself, the first human being in space, totally in secret. If something goes wrong on the pad, if something blows up, or if one of these bombs blows up the spacecraft, then that will be kept secret. If the launch is successful, then it's announced. And that's how they did it. It's completely different from the way the Americans did it. Because in the United States, everything was actually announced. Everything was on television. Everything was shown. Everything was sort of open. But in the Soviet Union, everything was closed. Everything was secret. Nothing was on live television at all. It was very kind of carefully controlled to protect Soviet secrets. So this climate of secrecy is so strong that even the guys that are astronauts, or what they call cosmonauts, training to beat the American astronauts into space, even those guys are not allowed to tell their own families what on earth they're training for.
Now, let's make one thing absolutely clear. The space race is on before we send any human, or before they send a human up into space.
Yeah.
It's on, and it's public knowledge that the space, I mean, Sputnik and those satellites and the dogs, everybody on both sides knows that the race is on.
Yes, they know the race is on, but the Soviets are very, very, very cagey about letting on to their human space program. I mean, they're incredibly careful about, you know, what they say and what they don't. They drop hints in the press. They drop hints in the media, but nothing concrete at all. And in fact, there's an interesting thing, which is that the United States was doing very badly in the space race after 1957. The Soviets got there with the first satellite, Sputnik, as you say. They got there with the first animal in orbit, which is this dog Laika that we talked about. I mean, you know, they are really ahead of the Americans. They got bigger rockets. They can lob bigger things into orbit. I mean, it's incredible for us to think, but actually the Soviets, who seemed at the time to be so technologically backward, were actually ahead of the United States quite substantially. So to get ahead of the Soviets in this incredibly critical political time with the two superpowers in the middle of a Cold War, the key then was to develop a spacecraft which could carry a human into space. And the Americans get ahead of the Soviets with this. They go with these seven famous astronauts called the Mercury Seven. They announce them at a press conference in Washington, D.C. in 1959. These guys become rock stars. They become celebrities almost overnight. I mean, even though they haven't flown yet, they're hot, hot test pilots. These guys are the right stuff through and through. The Soviets at that point hadn't got an astronaut or a cosmonaut training program, but they're watching everything that the Americans are doing. And so they react to the American decision to actually select the Mercury 7 by selecting their own cosmonauts, but to do it completely in secret. And where the Americans select 7, the Soviets select 20. And then they start training them in secrecy in a very strange compound in a forest outside Moscow, heavily guarded. And they start that process to beat the Americans into space.
Do you have to go in and pry open the archives to find this information? If it's happening in secrecy back then, at some point,
yeah.
I mean, the demise of the Soviet Union is a long way down the road, and I'm just imagining that it's not easy to even figure out where in some forest they were training in secret.
It was crazy. I mean, all I can say to you is that some of the things that were kept secret in 1961, 60 years ago, are still secret. Can you believe that? 60 years later.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the stuff was not actually revealed until 30, 40 years later. I mean, I'll give you an example. You were talking at the beginning about Yuri Gagarin landing, which he did in basically a potato field. He landed hundreds of miles off course in this sort of potato field. But the key thing about this is that the way he landed was kept secret for about 3 to 4 decades. Because what actually happened was that the technology was so unsophisticated relative to the American technology, but they were so determined to get ahead and take these risks that they didn't have a means of returning the cosmonaut back to Earth inside his spacecraft. It was too heavy. So he would have to eject at the last kind of 20, 25,000 feet like a kind of jet fighter. And he would parachute separately to the ground, which is how he met that old lady and her granddaughter picking potatoes in the potato field and terrifying the living daylights out of them. That's what happened. And the spacecraft would land on hard soil in Russia, in Mother Russia, separately. But because the Soviets wanted to claim the world speed and world altitude record, which is an international record, you have to land in the same craft that you take off in. That's one of the rules. So they simply lied about it. They simply said he did land in his spacecraft. There was no question of him parachuting separately. He landed in his spacecraft. And they maintained that lie for half a century. I mean, it's quite incredible that we're not talking about a year or two. We're talking about decade after decade and beyond even the demise of the Soviet Union. So for me, it was about delving into archives, but even more so, it was about interviewing people. I mean, I met a lot of eyewitnesses, many of whom have since passed away, and I interviewed them, some of them the very first time they'd ever talked about this stuff in their lives. And they told me stories which feed into my book and I think give it some real dramatic tension, because we are revealing stories that no one knows as I tell the story, as we go along to this kind of gripping moment when Gagarin finally gets into orbit.
You know, he didn't live for very many years after that event. As a test pilot, he crashed.
Mysteriously.
Oh, is that so? Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of conspiracies about whether he was murdered. And possibly murdered by the KGB. I mean, if you go online and you look up Yuri Gagarin death, you'll see tons. It's like, it's like Kennedy's death. It's like Princess Diana. It's one of those iconic figures, because in Russia, this guy is still a massively iconic figure, like Neil Armstrong is in the United States and in the West. And the manner of his death actually launched a huge kind of series of investigations and question marks about how he died in a fighter plane in circumstances which are still not quite clear, and nobody quite knows what really happened.
Yeah.
Was he murdered? Was he not? What happened? It's still not known.
Well, if I wanted to buy into a conspiracy here, it ties right into the question I was about to ask, which is that for him to live for a few years afterwards and have to keep mum about all of this, I mean, he couldn't tell people that he parachuted down, because that was a state secret.
No. And actually, he has an autobiography called Road to the Stars, which was not actually written by him at all. It was, in fact, written by two journalists from Pravda, which is the propaganda organ of the Soviet Union at the time. And they wrote it for him. And if you read it, it's extraordinary, because he describes in it, he describes the moment when he kind of travels around the world and he is looking down, and all he's thinking about is the blessed motherland and the communist motherland and how glorious it is and the workers' revolution. That's what he's talking about. But the reality is that Yuri Gagarin, the day after his incredibly dangerous flight, when he circled the world in 106 minutes, I mean, it's extraordinary, at a speed of 10 times a rifle bullet. We're talking 18,000 miles an hour, the sort of speed that would get you from say, New York to London in about 12 minutes. And he travels in a kind of a padded cannonball, basically. I mean, it's incredibly primitive, really, for any period. It's extraordinary. And it took real, I mean, there's no question, it took real guts to do this. But in the day literally following his flight, he gave a secret briefing, another secret. He gave a secret briefing, which was tape recorded, and I managed to get hold of the tape. And in it, he describes to very key people who organized his flight what really happened. And what really happened is that on several occasions in the course of that 106 minutes, he was terribly, perilously close to dying, and dying really horribly, actually. But he also describes something which I think is an epic moment for humanity. It's something that comes back to what you said in your introduction, actually, Marcus, which is that he actually describes the moment approximately 13 minutes after launch on April the 12th, 1961, where he reaches orbit and he can feel himself floating off his seat, and he looks to his right where there is a porthole. And this is all described in the secret briefing. And he looks out of the window and he sees the Earth as nobody has ever seen it. I mean, no human eye, no eye has seen the Earth as he first saw it. We're used to those images from the International Space Station, from space. This was the first human being to look down on our beautiful world and to see not just how beautiful it is, but also how fragile it is and how borderless it is as well. And it is his description is quite, I mean, you can feel this exhilaration and sense of wonder as he sees this planet, which is so blue and beautiful, and this incredible blackness of the sky and the stars, which don't twinkle because there's no atmosphere to make it twinkle, and the sun sort of sliding past his porthole. I mean, it's a moment of great wonder, and it's an epic moment because it's the first time any being on this planet in 3.5 billion years of organic existence had actually escaped the planet and was able to have that view. It is really quite pivotal. In my mind, it's actually more important even than the remarkable lunar landings in 69, because it's the first person to step into that, as I call it, beyond.
It's quite possible that he had more opportunity in terms of the percentage of time available to him to just be rubbernecking, looking out the window, to be a tourist, to be because of his functions, which apparently were very few. We're going to talk about what he was tasked with doing while he was in that capsule after a short break here on our show. We'll come right back to Stephen Walker. He's joining with us now to talk about his new book titled Beyond, The Astonishing Story of the First Human to Leave Our Planet and Journey into Space. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. It's a pleasure to have Stephen Walker with us. He's a documentary filmmaker and a writer. His new book is titled Beyond, The Astonishing Story of the First Human to Leave Our Planet and Journey into Space. I wanted to talk about his functions. He had time to look out the window, but apparently his functions were very few.
He was there to endure the mission, not to fly it. That's the key. I mean, these early space missions were far too fraught with risk to entrust a human being actually to control the spacecraft. I mean, even the Mercury spacecraft. And in fact, it's interesting because the first American in space, Alan Shepard, the famous astronaut Alan Shepard, who went on to actually hit the first golf ball on the moon in Apollo 14, he had a little bit of control with his own Mercury spacecraft, which went up 23 days later. I mean, the race between the two superpowers was that close. He had a little bit of control. And that's partly because he, as a very, very experienced test pilot, along with the other Mercury astronauts, demanded it from the engineers. They absolutely insisted on having that measure of control. Yuri Gagarin and his fellow 19 trainee cosmonauts were younger than the Americans. They were about 10 years younger than their American rivals. And they were actually not nearly as experienced pilots. They were guys who were serving in the Soviet Air Force. They were frontline pilots. Gagarin was actually right on the front line in flying jets on the NATO, literally on the border with NATO in Norway. But he was not a test pilot like Alan Shepard, nothing like the same level of experience. So they didn't have that clout, they didn't have that fame, they weren't in Life magazine or its equivalent in the Soviet Union as all the Mercury astronauts were. Their job was to be kind of like us, to be sort of dogs in a way. And one of the things I say in the book, and I don't think this is far-fetched, is that the interior of the Vostok, as it was called, the Vostok spacecraft, Vostok means east, when you compare it to the Mercury spacecraft interior, what you're actually saying something about is not just technology, but ideology. You're saying something about the difference between a nation which does not really trust its citizens, does not want them to have much autonomy or individuality, expects obedience, and lets others effectively do the commanding and the running of things, and a nation and an ideology which actually embraces individuality and freedom of action. And I really do think the difference is startling. There's a photograph in my book, which a lot of people on my Twitter handle and so on have seen as well. They get sort of quite fascinated by, which is that you see the Vostok spacecraft interior looks like the interior of a 1960s, quite simple, quite primitive automobile. I mean, it really has, I think it has four dials on it, a few switches, and it has a little kind of globe, which would look like the sort of thing you might find in a schoolroom, except much smaller, which was a navigational instrument. And kind of, you know, switches to make things hotter and colder, or you know, I mean, it really wasn't, there was nothing much for the cosmonaut to do compared to the Americans, who have this very state-of-the-art for its day, sophisticated instrumentation in their cockpit. So you are dealing with somebody who is not expected to fly. But I should just very quickly say that they were scared, they being the guys that were designing this machine, that something could go wrong, and that in the end it might be necessary for the Soviet cosmonaut, in this case Yuri Gagarin, actually to take control of his spacecraft. But they didn't trust him, as I said. So what they ended up doing, and this is incredible, they ended up giving him the possibility of control, but putting the controls in a coded system. They locked them. And the cosmonaut would have to actually enter three digits on a code before he was able to unlock the controls. And they put the digits for this code in an envelope, which was then sealed and then sort of glued somewhere inside the lining of the cabin. I mean, this is just unbelievable. You couldn't make this stuff up. So somehow the cosmonaut, if something went wrong, would have to find this envelope, undo the envelope, take out a piece of paper, read these three numbers, press the three numbers on this little panel inside his otherwise very bare cockpit, and then, even though he hadn't been properly trained for this, somehow take control of the spacecraft and fly it back to Earth. It was that crazy, and it was that untrusting. That's how it functioned. Utterly different from the way it was in the United States with NASA.
Tell us the story of his friend Titov.
Well, Titov is a remarkable guy. So basically, on the United States, my book is all about rivalries. It's about duels, you know, two sets of gladiators. You know, you've got the American famous Mercury astronauts, and you've got the Soviet not famous secret cosmonauts. The two front runners on the American side are Alan Shepard, who ended up being the first American in space, and also John Glenn, who many people will know of, who became the first American to orbit the Earth a year later, or just less than a year later. But you have a very similar rivalry on the Soviet side. In fact, it's a more interesting rival, and for this reason. You have Yuri Gagarin and this guy German Titov. Titov was at one point almost certainly going to be the first man in space. He is the same age, roughly, as Gagarin. He's this very handsome guy, very bright, very actually rather brilliant, a fantastically good pilot. Unlike Gagarin, he's got more experience, actually. And what makes them so interesting is that they are both rivals for first place, but they're also the closest of friends. And they live in adjoining apartments with their families. And in late 1960, several months into their training, and a few months before this key, this kind of epic flight, something terrible happens with Titov. His baby son, Igor, who's about 8 months old at the time, dies. And it's such a huge tragedy. In fact, it's such a huge tragedy that when I interviewed Titov's wife in Moscow about a year ago, she couldn't really talk about it at all. It was still too raw after 60 years. But what she was able to say, and I've heard this from other people too, other witnesses too, is that the Gagarin and his wife, who had a baby daughter roughly the same age, were fantastically supportive to the Titovs in this moment of their tragedy. They were really, really great supports. They were very loving. They were there a lot of the time in the apartment. It was a really close friendship. So what you've got are these two men who are united by this terrible tragedy, I mean bonded in a sense by this tragedy that happens to Titov's son, who really love each other. They're comrades in arms. They really are. Yet only one of them can be first. And the decision as to which one it's going to be is, as I describe in my book, is only taken, it's very dramatic, is only taken 3 days before the flight. It happens on April the 9th, 1961. So they've been training for well over a year. And then 3 days before, they are called into the office of the chief of cosmonaut training. And we know this because this guy kept a secret diary, which I use a lot in the book, where he's actually at the center of events and describes things completely illegally. He could have gone to a gulag labor camp if he'd been caught, but he did it nevertheless. And it's extraordinary because you have a sort of a fly on the wall kind of sight of what's going on right at the center of these events. So this guy calls these two men in and he says, without much ado, Yuri Gagarin, you're first. German Titov, you're his backup and you're second. And the two men walk out and Gagarin goes his way. And Titov, although he tries not to show it, is devastated. I mean, he's completely broken by this. He's absolutely devastated. And what actually happens, and this is really quite extraordinary, is that there is a moment where a friend of his comes up to him and says, why are you so devastated? This is not such a terrible thing. Why are you so devastated? And he says, who was the first man to discover America? And the guy says, it was Christopher Columbus. And he says, and who was the second man? And this friend says, I don't know. And Titov says, that's the point. You don't know. He was condemned forever to be second. He's like Buzz Aldrin with Neil Armstrong. He is the number two forever. And that's how he's still remembered in Russia. It's Yuri Gagarin is this huge, huge figure still. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. You cross that border and suddenly he's way more famous than Neil Armstrong is in Russia. He's got that same kind of iconic clout, if you like, that aura. But Titov, he was second. Nobody remembers second.
You have so many stories to tell, and we're not going to get to just a few of them. But I'm, for instance, the idea that there were gauges placed under their beds the night before to see who slept the best. You know, that's just fascinating stuff.
I know.
But let's back away from these personal stories, of which there are many, and maybe in summation here, can you situate this episode in history in such a way that sheds light on whether or not this really even mattered for geopolitics? I mean, yes, there's a race. Yes, people want to be first. Yes, we're trying to prove a technical prowess, technological prowess. Mm. But why should it even matter to the Cold War?
I mean, it's a great question. This is utterly and totally central to the Cold War, actually, and actually to the fate of the world. And that may seem like a far-fetched thing to say, but you have to spin back to a world that we do not, thank God, inhabit any longer. In 1961, when this event takes place, the world is essentially very divided. It's not just divided between the USSR and the United States, between communism, if you like, and democracy, all of which is true. It is also that the Soviet way at that point looked to many neutral nations, some of them emerging from the British Empire, for example, all over Africa and elsewhere, and across Southeast Asia, huge swathes of territory around the globe, South America as well, were looking for leadership. Would that leadership come from the Soviet Union and from the premier there, Khrushchev, or would it come from the United States and from its young and untested president, John F. Kennedy? Where would that leadership come from? Which way was the future way? It's actually a point that Kennedy picks up in his inaugural speech in January 1961. He really makes a point about those uncommitted nations in a really dangerous Cold War that might threaten at some point to turn hot, and if so, would destroy potentially the whole planet. So in this race, to put a human being in space is not just which nation has the better technology. What it actually is about is which way so many of these neutral or apparently neutral, not necessarily committed nations right the way around the globe, which way will they go? Which way is the future way? And both sides understood it. Kennedy understood it belatedly, which is why he started a new space race on the back of failing in the first space race. He failed with the first human in space. He didn't see the significance of that until too late. Then he saw it and realized that he had to take advantage of this and do something, because his, in a sense, everything that he stood for needed, he needed to show the world that the United States could do more than the Soviets and could go further than the Soviets and was the nation for these uncommitted other nations to turn to. And so ultimately, he goes for the moon, which he doesn't want to do. He's not a space person, Kennedy, at all, but he makes that decision to do that. And it's a race that the Soviets lost, ultimately, in 1969. So what you have in 61 is everything is hanging on a trigger, literally on a trigger. You're fighting wars by other means, because to fight a hot war with nuclear missiles, as I said, means the end of the planet. You're fighting to influence, to draw huge parts of the globe towards your way, because your way represents the future way. And in this race, which comes right down very dramatically to almost a photo finish, it comes down to a matter of 23 days, and it could have really gone the other way, where the Americans are just behind the Soviets. In that race rests quite literally the destiny politically of the planet. I mean, I really think that's the case. And everything is going wrong for Kennedy at this point. He actually loses the race with Yuri Gagarin, who comes first. And within less than 48 hours after the Yuri Gagarin debacle, the disaster from the American point of view, you're suddenly into a disastrous American or CIA-backed invasion of Cuba in an attempt to rid Cuba of its communist and rather pro-Soviet leader, Fidel Castro. That goes horribly wrong as well. So within a week, Kennedy's lost to the Soviets in space with Yuri Gagarin, who's being lauded all over the world, and he's also lost in Cuba. And he has to do something, which is why he makes, as I say, that decision that is against his own internal instincts or his own internal interest, I should say, and makes this massive leap to spend unaccountable amounts of money and do this crazy, ambitious, magnificent, but unbelievably controversial thing, which is to put Americans on the moon and to do it within a decade. And it's fascinating that the famous speech that Kennedy gives to Congress, where he asks for funds to do just this crazily ambitious, he wouldn't use the word crazily, of course, this unbelievably ambitious thing, that happens just a slightly more than a month after Yuri Gagarin is triumphantly orbiting the Earth and ends up in that potato field with the grandmother and the granddaughter.
Last of all, as you were preparing this and writing it and researching it, Was there any one moment that you could point to for you personally where Yuri Gagarin was closest to your understanding or your feelings? I'm wondering if there was an artifact that you saw that or you already mentioned speaking with Titov's widow, but I'm wondering if there was a moment that was most palpable, that was the most immediate for you.
There was one extraordinary, many, many moments. I mean, I was very privileged to go not just across Russia and Kazakhstan, which is where the Cosmodrome was. I'll come back to that because that's really the key. And also the United States in Houston and in Florida, where I met some amazing people that were also part of the early NASA days as well. Incredible people there too. But there was one moment that really summed it up for me. I was really lucky, actually, because I got to see the very last rocket launch from the pad from which Gagarin had flown into space in 1961. I got to see the last rocket to launch from that same pad. It's known as Gagarin's pad, in Baikonur, which is the cosmodrome, as they call it, the rocket complex in Kazakhstan, which used to be part of the Soviet Union, into September 2019. And this was an incredible launch. It was a Soyuz rocket launch to the International Space Station. There were three astronauts on board. One of them was Russian. One of them, I think, was from the United Arab Emirates. And one of them was a NASA astronaut called, I think it was Jessica Meir. And the three of them were on board this ship. And I think that the NASA astronaut had her whole family had flown in from America, and they were all kind of watching. And it was incredible because it was a sunset launch. And I'd never seen a rocket launch at that point. I have seen some subsequently at Cape Canaveral, but this is my first one. And the Russians allow you to get really close. I mean, we were like a mile away. And this is a huge rocket. It's very similar to the rocket that Yuri Gagarin flew in 61. Sunset launch. And we're all watching this thing. And suddenly the sky just lit up. I mean, it was incredible, but it lit up in silence because, of course, the sound is slightly too far away to begin with. So you get this incredible sort of almost like a sun rising, even though it's the end of the day, it's sunset, and the flash of light. And then this absolutely unbelievable wall of sound that just hammers into you, bores into you. You know, it is the most, you can feel, it's like an earthquake. It's so loud and it's physical too. You can feel yourself moving with this. It's the shockwave essentially from this noise of this massive rocket. And then this thing starts to rise. And you think, my God, there are three people on board this thing. You know, this woman's mother is watching her daughter go to space. And up it goes. And with this tremendous roar, this great tail of light. And my reaction was unexpected. I was profoundly moved. I wasn't just excited, which I was, mesmerized, slightly stunned by this kind of physical assault of noise and sight. But also, there was something terribly moved. These are people leaving the Earth. This isn't like getting an aeroplane. This is actually leaving the planet. And this is what Gagarin did from that same place, except no one had done it before. No one had sat on top of an intercontinental ballistic missile, as essentially he had, and someone lit the candle. This was what he did. And there was it made it suddenly viscerally real for me, seeing this rocket, that pad, and thinking that then it was 58 years previously, the first human being to sit on top of one of these monstrous things and then leave the planet vertically upwards into the sky, that somebody could do that and in a sense change history made everything sort of make sense, if that makes sense. It suddenly became not just about the politics we've been talking about, the technology, the numbers of dials, it became a very visceral felt moment of connection and of admiration, I have to say, for not just him, but for every astronaut and cosmonaut anywhere that does the same thing, because it is a remarkable thing to see human beings leave our planet.
Stephen Walker, such a pleasure to have some moments with you. Thank you for telling the story and for being with us today. A pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Stephen Walker's book is titled Beyond, The Astonishing Story of the First Human to Leave Our Planet and Journey into Space. The story of the space race on both the Soviet side and the American side is one of sacrifice and raw courage. This was true of the first humans to go beyond, to enter space, but it has been no less true every subsequent step along the way. Since 1961, 15 American astronauts have died in spaceflight or training, and 4 Russian or Soviet cosmonauts. In 2003, after an otherwise successful mission, the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated during re-entry. That tragedy was just the beginning of the effort to bring Columbia home. A story of commitment and community in the face of disaster when we return to Constant Wonder in just a moment. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. February 1st, 2003, the Space Shuttle Columbia disintegrates on re-entry, killing all 7 astronauts aboard and scattering debris over rural areas of East Texas. What followed after that is the incredible story of community involvement and an outpouring of support from all kinds of people as NASA worked to bring Columbia home. I learned the story from Mike Leinbach, NASA's final Space Shuttle Launch Director at the Kennedy Space Center, and from Jonathan Ward, a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and an executive coach at the Center for Creative Leadership. These two gentlemen, Leinbach and Ward, are co-authors of Bringing Columbia Home, The Untold Story of a Lost Space Shuttle and Her Crew. I want you to hear a highlight from our conversation. It begins with Jonathan Ward explaining why Columbia is the forgotten tragedy.
When I talk to people who are not involved in the space community or involved in science and things like that, you ask them if they remember the Columbia accident, and they will describe the space shuttle launching and then exploding, and I'll say, wait a minute, that was Challenger. And people said, oh, yeah, I remember that. And then you ask them about Columbia, and they have a harder time conjuring up that image. I think after you describe it to them, some of them will start remembering that. But part of the problem we had with Columbia was that it occurred right at the time that the country was also preparing for possible invasion of Iraq. It was only 16 months after 9/11, and so we had a lot on our minds as a country. And I think that's one of the reasons that people don't remember it quite so well if you weren't in Texas or if you weren't involved in the space community.
You know, a curious thing for me personally is that just the fact that both of those shuttles begin with the letter C. One is Columbia, the other is Challenger, and they have multiple syllables. If it had been a shuttle by another name where they were a little bit more distinct, I would be able to remember and differentiate better between them. Have you ever stumbled across that, Mike?
Well, that's an interesting point, and to be honest with you, no. That's the first time I've heard that analogy between the two names, and I find the same thing Jonathan finds. I give tours at the Kennedy Space Center, and we get a lot of American guests and international guests, and the accident they typically reference is the Challenger because we all saw it on TV, and it had the teacher in space on board, Kristen McAuliffe, and so had a little bit more notoriety than the Columbia mission. But Columbia was first orbiter to fly, and really led the way for all the rest, and was really our sentimental favorite here at the Kennedy Space Center.
Now that you mentioned that Columbia was the first to fly, you probably could tell us, and I understand that this particular orbiter was technologically designed somewhat differently from the subsequent ones. It was somehow unique, Mike.
Well, it was. It was the first one, as I mentioned, and it had an escape system for 2 astronauts on the first 4 flights, for the commander and the pilot. It also had quite an extensive instrumentation suite on board the vehicle to characterize how it flew in space and during ascent and landing, and had different temperature sensors and strain gauges, that type of thing, all over it. And that data all got collected inside of a magnetic tape recorder, and it was the closest thing to a flight data recorder that commercial airliners have today. And it's the only orbiter that had that equipment, and that turned out to be a key piece of data that we found when we found that box out in Texas. But, yeah, it was the first orbiter to fly, so we had to characterize how it behaved during ascent and entry in particular.
Now, Jonathan Ward, as I was learning about the Columbia recovery effort, and that's the focus of this book, I was interested in an editorial switcheroo that happened, because nowadays I think the book, the subtitle talks about the untold story, but there was an iteration of that subtitle earlier that talked about its final mission. Would you care to tell us why the recovery effort was the final mission?
Well, in a way, what was interesting about this, and Mike alluded to it as well, is that Columbia was primarily a research vehicle. It was the only one of the orbiters that was not flying missions to the International Space Station, and its last mission was a medical research mission. They were flying a SpaceHab module, and the seven astronauts on board were doing scientific and medical experiments 24 hours a day. And one of the things that came out of this, the tragedy, again, trying to find the silver lining in this, is that because of the accident, we were able to determine some of the flaws in the space shuttle system, which allowed the remaining space shuttle flights to operate successfully, but also because of an effort that was made to learn the lessons about how the hardware failed in Columbia, that we were able to make those take those lessons and make changes in subsequent design of space vehicles. You'll see that the new SpaceX capsules and the Orion vehicle that's going to be launched here all are carrying hardware that was redesigned as a result of what we learned from the Columbia accident. So in a way, that was a continuation of its research.
So, Mike, after the disaster, as the recovery effort was going on, people were already thinking, I was certainly thinking, this is such a setback that we're not going to see any future space shuttle flights at all. Were your thoughts in that time period similar?
Well, probably initially they went down that line, but then early on, we from day one, our administrator appointed an independent review board to study NASA, in particular this accident, and give us recommendations from an independent researcher's perspective. That was led by Admiral Hal Gaiman, who also did the USS Cole investigation of the terrorism attack. And his recommendations came out in three major recommendations. One was to finish the International Space Station using the space shuttle fleet, because those components were all built for to fly only on the shuttle. And then retire the shuttle when you were done with that. And while you were doing those two things, finishing the International Space Station and then retire the shuttle, build America's next launch system. And so that became our charge after about 6 months in after the accident. Admiral Gaiman came out with his major recommendations. And so then we knew we would fly for a number of more years to finish the ISS. But then the shuttle was destined to be retired in favor of another system. So we knew the end was coming. We had several years to prepare for it, prepare the workforce for it. But nevertheless, it was pretty traumatic when the space shuttles were finally retired.
Now, specific to the recovery effort, I would love to have both of you talk about the nature of the recovery effort, both from the human standpoint. We've already mentioned how thousands of people were involved from the communities, as well as personnel from NASA, the local law enforcement people involved in that as well. But specific to the machine itself, a surprising amount of material was actually recovered. Isn't that so, Mike?
Well, yeah, we found 38% of the orbiter by weight. It's a 200,000-pound vehicle empty when it flies. So we found 84,000 pounds of Columbia, but it was spread over an area 120 miles long and 10 miles wide, which was the area that we physically walked on the ground out in deep East Texas and over into Louisiana slightly. Most of the pieces were very small, size of your cell phone or smaller. We got back several large pieces. Window frames in particular are on display at the Kennedy Space Center, along with a piece of the Challenger vehicle. But we combed that area, that 120 miles by 10 miles wide, physically walked it, looking down on the ground for debris, looking up in trees. We crossed streams and ponds, and it was in February. It was very cold, and it was just terrible conditions to go out and comb the fields for debris, but that's what we did. And the local people were just fantastic about it. They gave us permission to walk all their lands, and they helped us do that and helped us protect the equipment when we found some, and our astronauts themselves, by the way. And so it was a blessing in disguise that Columbia came down where she did in deep East Texas, as opposed to a more suburban area, which could have happened. And so the people of East Texas are to be congratulated and loved, and that's the way we feel about them.
No damage to either structures or to people on the ground?
No, not, very, very minor damages to structures. Maybe a shed was hit by a piece of debris. A piece of Columbia came down through the roof of a school and landed by a teacher's desk, but it was a Saturday morning, so school was out. We didn't hurt anybody on the ground during the accident, so that was another blessing. From that perspective, it could have been much, much worse than it was.
Jonathan, Mike just a moment ago was mentioning the window frames, and I know that you have spoken of this particular category of item. You know, when I see a jetliner or even the space shuttle, pictures of those, those windows, kind of like the front of a car, they can resemble a face. It's almost like the cockpit windows are eyes. Is that the reason that the window frames seem to speak to us in a way that something else might not from the debris?
Well, I will tell you that they are among the most powerful things that I've ever seen. Every time I go down to visit Mike and then go to visit the space shuttle Atlantis building, and I go in there and go into the Forever Remembered exhibit, and I look at those window frames. And I think part of the thing is that I can see in my mind's eye the crew looking back at me. And, you know, I can just imagine them on the other side of those windows. And that's just an image that always stays with me. And I think this is something that I said on a number of occasions is when I was putting the book together with Mike, as I was finishing it up, you know, I went down there to the Forever Remembered and looked at the window frames and imagined looking the crew in the eye through those cockpit window frames and wanting to tell them that I had done the best job that I possibly could to try to help tell their story. And it was a very powerful moment for me, and it still is one of those things I can never exactly tell how I'm going to react when I'm down there, but it really is. It is the most human part, I think, of the space shuttle that we got back again, and what a blessing it is that we were able to find them like we did, and to be able to preserve those, and that also that the families agreed that they serve as a powerful lesson for all of us to be able to, for the public to be able to see those.
Mike Linebach and Jonathan Ward, they are co-authors of Bringing Columbia Home, The Untold Story of a Lost Space Shuttle and Her Crew. Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, a little bit like the Elon Musks of their generation, and like Elon Musk, when you unleashed Ford or Edison, you weren't always sure what you're going to get, but there was a good chance it would be worth watching. And when you put Ford and Edison together on a single project, well, you might electrify a literal backwater of America. They aimed to build a futuristic city. Did they pull it off? We're going to find out tomorrow here on Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.